Welcome to a very special edition of There's Just Something About Kansas City. I can't be more excited about this than the two people who are sitting right here beside me. We're talking about the Disney 100, the exhibition, which is at Union Station through November of 2024. And sitting right next to me, Becky Klein. She's director of archives for Disney. And of course, my good friend, old buddy, George Guastella, who is the president and CEO of Union Station. I've got to ask the two of you, okay? And we'll go back for memories because I have a lot of Disney memories, as I'm sure George does, and Becky, I know you do as well. But just the idea, this is only one of five cities in the entire world to get this exhibition. How did this happen? And I think one of the reasons is sitting to your left.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yeah, we decided we wanted to travel this exhibition in two units. So we created two exact duplicates of this exhibition, and we opened one in Philadelphia, and then we opened the other one in Munich. And since that time, the Munich version went to London, and the Philadelphia version went to Chicago and then came here. And I think we've worked out the kinks enough that it can be beautiful here in Kansas City where it belongs.
Yeah, well, it'll be perfect here. We've gotten all the kinks out of it, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, and that's what. And George, for you, where was the initial idea? Did you hear that they were going to do this and you decided we want to be part of this? Or how did this work for Union Station?
And it's all about relationships. So we're very fortunate to have a good relationship with the Semmel Company that first produced King Tut many years ago, almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It launched them on an international basis in the United States, and it did very well. And they were wanting us to do a Marvel show. And just lo and behold, they just couldn't come up with it. And I said, but I've been hearing about Disney. No, you're too small. And I said, we're never too small.
No.
And we were kind of saying, well, maybe it can't come here. And so we made a couple of calls to Hallmark, which happened to be the very first licensee. Don't ever stop Guastella to get what he wants. And then somehow the next day, there it was. So that was one. But this really means something special because Union Station is the visual voice of Kansas City.
Yes, it is.
It's all about memories. So we're able to relive the memories of Walt and carry it all the way to today. So everybody that goes through all these exhibitions has a moment in time in the gallery to remember something special. And they'll be able to carry that memory on to future generations. And that's what made it so special. And then we had the opportunity to make sure we had a chance to meet Becky. She brought us to her home. And this is the most brilliant Walt Disney person. I swear to you, if Walt was alive today, here it is. Brilliant. And you can just talk to her and you feel the emotion. And the first thing she said to us, please make sure to make Walt's life come to life in a home that he was at.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
We're very honored.
He was here.
He walked these halls. He worked from here.
Yeah, from 10 years until he went back to Chicago for a while, and then he came back again. And we'll talk about it as we go. But
he showered here, by the way.
He worked at Union Station.
Yeah. So what did he do here,
Becky?
He was a news butcher on the trains, and so he sold soda pop and peanuts and fruit and things on the trains, and he would go in and out of Union Station out to the different points. About 20 cities, I believe, Kansas and Missouri.
Oh, that is amazing. From probably a pretty young age then,
yeah,
right?
I think he was about 14.
Okay.
15 when he did that.
Oh, God, just before he went back to Chicago then, he did something.
He spent the summer here doing it.
Right. He was always fascinated by the railroads.
Oh, he loved
trains.
Because
when he was in Marceline, he was right beside the railroad, and that's the Atchison, Topeka, Santa Fe Railroad was right there, and that's where he got his fascination with railroads. And I remember
he had an uncle who was an engineer.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. Wow.
And so he'd toot the horn every time they came through, and the kids would go running out and catch a ride on the train into the station in town.
And we have such great railroad history here in Kansas City anyway. You know, it's just phenomenal for him to have done that. That is, I didn't know that part. I knew he was fascinated by the railroads because I remember seeing the bit when he was at his home in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. He had the miniature train in his backyard, which you could see him. He'd ride around on a little of that to introduce some shows or to do whatever. And then I heard he had to get rid of it because every time he had a party, all the partygoers, they were falling off the train and getting hurt. So
he even took Salvador Dali rode on that
train.
Oh
my gosh.
Yeah, Kurt Douglas and all kinds of people in his backyard.
So there's a replica upstairs in the grand area, which is the Reed train, that was built for the president and CEO of the Santa Fe. And you can see it upstairs. It's almost identical to what Mr. Walt Disney created.
Yes.
But that was in Hit, not Walt's, in Mr. Reed, the president's backyard. And when he passed away, John Chedrid, they gave us that.
Oh,
so it's
great.
Upstairs as a remembrance.
Oh, gosh.
And they gave it to us probably 15 years ago, and we've never turned back. So there's this emotion. It is so magnificent to have Walt back in his home.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know?
So Walt was born in Chicago, obviously, but at age four, his family moved. He was born in 1901. They moved to Marceline, which isn't very far from Kansas City.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he started there, I guess, when he was at home. He started sketching things, and it was his neighbors. There's a doctor neighbor, and it
Dr.
was his
Sherwood.
Horse, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He had a horse named Rupert that Walt loved the animals on the farm and all the neighboring animals. And so Dr. Sherwood paid him some money, a little bit of money, to draw a portrait of Rupert. So that was something. It was one of his first commissions.
Yeah, and then I heard he got in a little trouble about drawings on the side of the house.
Yeah, while his parents were away, he and his sister, he convinced his sister it would be okay to draw on the side of the house with some tar. And he got in trouble when the folks got home.
Yeah, I'll bet. But he started at a very young age. And being on a farm, now we know the transition for all the animals, because you have Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, and then eventually, which will morph into Mickey Mouse, which we'll tell that story as well. So that's where he got his beginnings and where the first germ was planted in his brain, right?
Well, that's where he got his love of nature. He used to call it belly botany, where he'd lay out on his tummy on the ground and look at all the insects in the grass. And that's where he learned to love animals and nature.
Wow.
And it was throughout his entire career. He did the True Life Adventures, which were the beginnings of nature documentaries. He was really the first person to do nature documentaries in Hollywood. And, he always loved animals. And the animal life runs through all of his cartoons and his feature films and TV and everything.
So
when you think about this, it's really a lifelong story. Mm-hmm. The agrarian values that he grew up with really has carried it on, that made him the entrepreneur that he was. Mm-hmm. And our ability, and thanks to Becky connecting us with Kay at the Walt Disney Hometown Museum in Marceline, we had the opportunity to go to the farm, experience it, see the dreaming tree or wishing tree?
The
dreaming tree that was hit by... it was always there. It was hit by
lightning.
See, it's hard for me to remember.
Yeah, right.
Like that.
Okay, yeah.
But we have a piece of the original bark upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about those memories and those agrarian values and the commitment to his family and his all of what he wanted to do. What better place to tell that story?
Yeah, right.
It was really formative for him here.
Yeah.
In both Marceline and Kansas City.
Yeah, right. So they move. What precipitated the move from Marceline to Kansas City?
They had a farm in Marceline.
Right.
And Elias got sick and was unable keep the farm going. And the two older brothers decided to leave, and they came to the big city here in Kansas City. And it was just a little too hard for Elias to keep the farm going. So they moved into town in Marceline. And then Robert Disney, Elias's brother, so Walt's uncle, who supported him throughout his career, Robert had land in Marceline. He also, they kind of tried to make it there and ended up coming to Kansas City, where Elias bought a paper route from the Kansas City Star. And so he had a job opportunity here and moved the family.
Right.
The determination really speaks to, I think, the core values of our community. You have to be that entrepreneur. And when he gets here, and Becky will tell us a little bit about it, you got to imagine he's 18 years old when he creates Laugh-O-Gram Studios.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was the gamer of that time. So there was never a time that I've been able to learn that he never gave up. When somebody told him he couldn't do it,
right,
he did it. That's what I think the true determination of the entrepreneurial spirit that's based in agrarian values really bring to our community.
Yeah, right. And they move here, and you talk about he bought a paper route, and who was delivering the papers, but he and his brother at 3:30 in Roy.
Mostly Walt, yeah.
Yeah, Walt and Roy at 3:30 in the morning. And then I guess they delivered again in the afternoon, right?
Yeah, two times
a day
in all weather. And then trying to go to school during the daytime, he and his younger sister ended up in the same grade because of Walt missing some school. And so they went to school at Benton School.
Yeah, Benton Grammar.
Benton Grammar. And that's where, Walt met Daisy Beck, who was his favorite teacher. And she encouraged him to draw. And then he took some classes at the Kansas City Art Institute on Saturdays. And this is where he learned to be an animator. He taught himself animation by checking out books from the library. And, you know, it's just, this is where his formative years were.
Right. And the interesting part, he was not a great student because of the paper route.
Yeah,
because
he
and his brother were so tired during the day, they just fall asleep.
They'd fall asleep in class, right?
Gosh, that's and crazy.
Fortunately, he had teachers who were understanding, but still, it was very difficult work.
Yeah.
When you see the fabric and how it interacts, you can start to see how his life creates this magic for nearly 100 years. Mm-hmm. So Becky shared with us the concept of the book that he would check out. So then that allowed us to go speak to the people at the Kansas City Museum, Kansas City Public Library. They still have the book. They pulled it out of their collection, and we will have it here for all of Kansasians to see and experience. And it was because of Becky's ability to tell us the story and then connect all those dots all the way down to the Kansas City Art Institute and UMKC.
It just goes on and on.
So many connections.
Right. And then he even did a correspondence school. I mean, he wasn't, he was never satisfied with where he was. He was always in a quest for learning, and was learning something that he loved. I think that was important. It wasn't like math or geography or something. He loved art, and he loved to draw, and he was going to use that to have a career, to succeed in life. Yes,
you know what's really interesting about Walt Disney, and I've discovered this over the last 35 years, is that he wasn't fully educated,
right?
You know, but he was extremely intelligent. And had one of those kind of memories where he absorbed everything he heard, especially if he was particularly interested. But he could absorb knowledge anywhere he went. He would listen to what was told him and then be able to repeat it back almost verbatim, you know, later. Things as space travel and things that he learned at the Houston, you know, at NASA. And he absorbed and kept everything and then found a new and innovative way to share it with the world.
To tell the story.
And so he was a brilliant, brilliant man.
He's just incredible. And in fact, I would think tremendous impact on my life, I'm sure George's and of course on yours as well. But I remember all the way back to 1954, I was 7 years old. We had TV for 3 years. Okay. Right. We had a TV for 3 years, which was the most incredible thing ever, because all we had in the house was radio, and I can remember that. But 1954, The Wonderful World of Disney, and when that would come on, there was never a promo for it like somewhere earlier in the day on television to let you know what was going to be on. It was going to be on, and you had no idea that night. And I can remember this, no idea that night what was going to be on that night. Right. And I always hoped it was Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, right? Or the Swamp Fox. Right. Uh-huh. Francis Marion and, you know, Swamp Fox.
Tail on his cap.
Nobody knows where Swamp Fox is at. I know I'd stutter my way through that one. But those types of things on Sunday nights was like the whole family gathered around that television.
Absolutely.
And it was one of these memories, even though it was so many years ago, is so vivid for me now as well.
And so many people have that. I mean, I spent every Sunday night, I spent, you know, around the TV, we'd have dinner at my grandparents' house, and then we would watch the show as a family.
Right.
And that was my grandma and grandpa time, you know, and that was really special, you know, and I remember it so vividly, even in glorious black and white. And then, of course, you know, then along came color.
Yeah.
So, everyone has
how about you,
that.
George? I'm
everyone
sure
has
you.
Those memories that it fulfilled their life. And when I walk through this exhibition, the first thing I experience is the Mary Poppins with the horse. Mm-hmm. That was my very first movie that I saw in the 1960s downtown at the Empire Theater with my aunt. It was a wonderful woman, and she would support me and say, oh, these great ideas. And then she'd say, now, go home to my dad, and she says, now sing that song, supercalifragilistic,
right?
And I never forget her. So when I'm there, I have a moment with my aunt. When I walk through, I have moments with my children. When I walk through the certain area, then it brings me back to my Broadway days. So all the things that we did at Starlight. Mm-hmm. So I had the opportunity to be the very first to produce Aida in Kansas City. So everything has a special moment. When I go into other rooms, I see experiences like The Lion King. That was the first Broadway show that my children saw. So that's the emotion and the connection. It's not about me, but it's those memories that connect you with others. And I think that's what he did.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do in this exhibition, is we decided not to tell a chronological story. We didn't want to say, you know, Walt did this, then he did this, and then he did this, and now we're doing this and this. Right. What we wanted to do was create galleries based on Walt's own philosophies and creative content and direction, and show how, you know, you have an artifact from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and something from Pinocchio, but you also have things from Tangled and Princess and the Frog, and show that they're all based on Walt's philosophies.
Right.
And that's kind of what we did, is that we were able to find things that connect with people of all ages. And every gallery you go into, you're going to find something that you remember as a child, but then your child or grandchild is also going to see the things that they'll remember 30, 40 years from now.
Right. I would venture a guess that there probably is no one in the civilized world or world where they could get a television or a satellite dish or whatever in the entire, on the entire globe, that hasn't been touched by Walt Disney.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you're right.
I don't think there's anyone else like that.
You know, I've traveled many places in the world, including Africa and other places that are fairly remote for most people. And literally, I've seen children carrying backpacks with, you know, Mickey Mouse and princesses on them and things. And everywhere I go, you know, China, I mean, Shanghai and other places in China and India, and you always see Disney in some form, mm-hmm. whether it's consumer products or a film poster or, you know, an advertisement for Disney Plus, wherever it happens to be. But it touches everyone, right. even in the remotest corners of the world.
And that's the sign of a true, brilliant entrepreneur that cares about lasting legacies. And it was really interesting. We asked, how did some of these things, I have sometimes a great opportunity to sit down with individuals that are great entrepreneurs and ask them the question, just to say, what was it like? Help me understand that. Everybody wants to tell you the story. So Mr. Hall Sr., I sat down with him one day. We were talking and we were working. I said, so I want to know one thing. What was it like when you and your father met Walt Disney? And then he carried on the whole story. Mm-hmm. That's what started to inspire us from that one conversation. Mm-hmm. And you think about Mr. K. Every entrepreneur leaves something special and yeah. wants that memory to continue on. I think that's what makes Walt Disney and Kansas City the quintessential experience where you tie it together.
Yeah, because you know? it is all tied together with that from him. And all those people you just mentioned yeah. as well, it was always about people,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it was positivity about people. It wasn't negativity, it was uplifting. It was a story that would start out like this and was wonderful, and then all of a sudden, you know, Cinderella goes to sleep, okay, yeah. or whatever. And, oh my gosh, now what's gonna happen? And yeah, but then the prince comes and gives her a kiss and she wakes up and life is, they live happily ever after, you know?
And I think you just put your finger on what makes Disney so special, and that was from Walt. He insisted on having real emotions and real personality mm-hmm. in these characters, starting with early as Oswald and Mickey, all the way up to the present day. You have to, you see these characters, you watch, this is animation, it's art on film, and you care about what happens to those people in these filmed entertainment pieces, whether it's TV, film, animation. You truly care about them as real people, and it's because he insisted on imbuing them with real distinct personality and then putting them in situations that are, you know, dire or happy
yeah.
or sad or whatever. But you really care about these people, and that's why you take those stories with you the rest of your life.
Yeah, they are fantasy, but they relate to your life as it is, as a person.
Because they act like real people. Yeah.
Right. It's connected to the past. Mm-hmm. And I must compliment Becky on this. You know, we love to take people on a journey. And this initial exhibition was very linear when it was set up because it needs to travel. But because of Becky understanding the same strategy, when you walk through this exhibition, it's not linear. Mm-mm. It's a journey, and everywhere you go has that emotion. You can look at something on a wall, a picture doesn't say it. It's right. the emotion behind it. Mm-hmm. So everyone is connected. And I think that's what will make this exhibition so relevant to the individuals in our community mm-hmm. because it connects it for everyone.
Right.
And that's the key.
Right, and it's an aha moment.
Right.
Yeah. For everyone, because I remember, I remember that.
Yeah.
And then the kids will go, I remember that.
That's the magic.
Yeah.
You know, every time you want to turn a corner, you want to see that artifact and it wants to pop out at you.
Yeah.
And when we were working with our team, the one thing that we discuss on a regular basis is everything has to be attention to detail. Everything you should see, the audience may not see it, but they certainly will feel it.
Right.
And when they feel it, that's the difference. So sometimes when we're doing things, I ask the team, when they play something, I said, would Walt do that? If he spent so much time on a trash can and where it was located, is this in the right spot? What did he want the customer to feel and experience? Right. And if you ask that question, you may not know him, but you can understand it. You go, you're right, that column shouldn't be there. That artifact shouldn't be there. We need to take it to a movement. Wow. And that's the evolution and this spirit that he lives on in other individuals.
Yeah, right. I think it's really let's talk about the very beginnings of some of this. Sure. Alice's Wonderland was the first, not Alice in Wonderland.
Alice
that
in
would
Cartoon
come live.
Land.
It was Alice in Cartoon Land in a Laugh-O-Gram, right? They did that for a while, and then that business sort of went under a little bit. They were very early. Then we get to Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, right?
Yeah.
And it became a very unlucky thing in the beginning for Walt and Roy.
Alice was fairly successful in a minor way. It was a silent cartoon series, and it was rather successful. It kind of ran its course, so they decided to create Oswald, which was more of a traditional animated character. Right. And he was very successful, too, but it wasn't a lack of interest in the character. It was skullduggery on the part of his distributor.
It was. The distributor stole the idea and stole away his animators,
yeah.
Right, and then that created a time for Walt when they had to really go, okay, that happened to us, and that could have destroyed everything.
Oh, yeah.
If it wasn't for Walt and Roy going, let's not let this stop us. Let's go on. We'll be smarter next time when we do this. But now, all of a sudden, they go, okay, Oswald's gone. Now what are we going to do?
Well, Walt was actually in New York trying to ask for more money for the series so he could make it better. He was always trying to make things better and higher quality. And he was there asking for money. And the distributor said, well, not only am I not going to give you any more money, but the character belongs to us. And when you get home, you'll find out you don't have an animation staff. And so on the train home, and so he you know, wrote a telegram to Roy about it and then said, don't worry, I'm thinking of something. And so on the train ride home, he was desperately trying to figure out what to do. And so when he got to California, they were still finishing up the last Oswalds. And so in secret, they created Mickey Mouse in their garage. So he had, I think, two animators, Roy and the two wives.
Right.
And they secretly created Mickey Mouse in the garage of their home while the other animators were finishing up the Oswalds at the studio. Sir.
So where did the mouse come from, the idea of it being, okay, we did a rabbit, we had Alice in Wonderland, that didn't, you know, we're done with that.
Yeah.
Where did the mouse come from?
Well, you know, Walt was a storyteller, you know, and he never let the truth get in the way of a good story, as long as it, you know. Worked.
Sounds like George.
Yeah, yeah. So, but he was a bit of a fabulist, and so he himself, through his lifetime, described different versions of how Mickey came to be. But the closest we can come to it is that, you know, he had a little mouse that, you know, he befriended as a young animator during Laugh-O-Gram days. And so he liked the mouse, but also he had to come up with something quick. So they took Oswald and kind of retooled him and made round ears and got rid of the fluffy tail and, you know, put a mouse tail on him. And you can see Oswald very, very much Mickey. You can see where it came from. So I think he was just desperately trying to come up with a new character on the way home and then pulled Ub aside and said, okay, we got to do something. And so together they came up with this idea of creating a mouse character.
And I think that's the true spirit of entrepreneurial creativity.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Your best work happens when you're underneath pressure and you have to think quickly. And obviously I study him, but that's what it is. When you read his books, it was that instantaneous creativity that was put under pressure by an entrepreneurship.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The other real key is the strategy of trust, right? He learned about trust, and then he also was affected by trust for those that broke the trust. Yeah. And, you know, what does Reagan say? Trust but verify.
Exactly.
Right? And I think, you know, you look at some of that stuff, and that's what sets you apart from your key stumblings to make you better.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key to his true genius.
Absolutely.
You keep mentioning Ub Iwerks, right?
Yeah.
He was
very important.
Ub was very, very important.
He's
and
from
I think,
here, too.
Yes, he's from here as well. And, of course, Roy, we know his connection you know, with Disney Studios, everything. But talk a little bit about Ub Iwerks. Yes.
Ubby Iwerks. He was of Dutch ancestry and lived here with his mother in Kansas City. And they met at Kansas City Film Ad Company as graphic artists. They were working there. And they met and connected and clicked and became good friends and then worked together to create over, I think they had a company called Iwerks Disney, which lasted about a month. you know, and the two of them tried multiple things together, but they were very, very dear friends and partners. And the amazing thing is that Walt was the storyteller and the creative, you know, drive of the company, and Ubs was an amazing animator. Mm-hmm. He was probably one of the fastest animators that ever lived. He could crank out an entire cartoon by himself in the time it was insane how good he was. And so the two of them as partners and friends, you know, really are what made Mickey Mouse special.
Yeah, and they were very innovative too, because they went from the paper cutouts, mm-hmm. which were the original round and round thing. If you stopped it too quick, the light would burn out the paper cutout, right?
Yeah, the early
But they went to celluloid,
they did
which
sell
was,
animation,
was
yeah.
not very old at that time. It had just been created a
few
years.
It was only about less than 20 years
before. Less than 20 years old, and then they went to the celluloid, mm-hmm. and that all of a sudden that becomes film. And then everything else goes from there.
And then, of course, Mickey Mouse, they had drawn two previous cartoons before Steamboat Willie, which was the first one the public saw. And, of course, that jumping on new technology, the Jazz Singer came out from Warner Brothers in 1928.
Right.
And at that point, Walt hadn't found a distributor for his first two Mickey cartoons because they were silent.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought, well, that's it, sound. We'll add synchronized sound. And so they created a brand new one, Steamboat Willie, featuring synchronized sound, and it was an overnight sensation when the public saw it.
Yeah.
So the creative idea of entrepreneurship, but always surrounding yourself with partners that can bring that creativity mm-hmm. and that new technology to
right.
life. And as I study Walt's life, he always had people around him
who believed
in him. But at a lot, and also had the expertise to bring it to life.
Mm-hmm,
you think of his brother, who was the quintessential banker, who worked at First National Bank in Kansas City.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
think
Roy
the
did.
Connection with yeah. he and Abu, I works in them when the people in Kansas City have a moment to understand. We had one of the very first iWorks theaters mm-hmm. here. So tonight, mm-hmm. we will be in the same room in a theater that was once Ub iWorks, celebrating not only his life, but his great friend in Walt Disney, and everyone else can learn that story. So we learn the history from Becky, but we understand the stories and the people behind it.
Yeah.
I think that's what's gonna make it so special here.
Oh yeah, I think so too. And I think everybody relates because Walt was from here. Walt,
right.
His family was from here, and everything they discovered and all their early innovations and all their entrepreneurship and everything they learned was here mm-hmm. to begin with before they went the Los Angeles, and became
and even
what they
in the first in the first gallery that Becky mm-hmm. put together, you'll see the Alice Shorts. If you really study that Alice Shorts sound, no sound. I mean, you could look at it, and you go, "Wow, that was kind of Mabel Normand, mm-hmm. who was the biggest star of the time mm-hmm. in silent movie." But it was for a child,
yes,
and that's the story. So you can see all of those connections coming together.
And the you're talking about people following him, not just Ub iWorks, but most of his animators came with him. Carl Stalling, who was very instrumental in Warner Brothers cartoons mm-hmm. and well known for that, but he started with Walt, got Walt started on the Silly Symphonies, which led into the cartoons with Donald Duck and led into the Fantasia and things that happened much later. But those folks came with him, Ub iWorks, Rudy Ising, Hugh Harmon, all of the folks that were here, and Virginia Davis, who was the little girl who played Alice,
yes, right.
did the pilot film with Walt in Kansas City. And then her parents were willing to move to California and bring Alice,
right.
Virginia was 4 or 5 years old, brought her to California. Roy's future wife, was also from Kansas City. So a number of good friends and people supported Walt and believed in him enough, even before he had great success, and came from Kansas City. And those were always the people that Walt trusted the most afterwards, because he knew them before he was a huge success, and they had been there for him. And that was great.
Right. I always want to know how he inspired people. Obviously people followed him, but yet he must have had an unbelievable aura about him
mm-hmm.
that brings people to him and that they trust. And it's that relationship. You know more than I, but there's something there. I wish I would have had the opportunity to be in a room. And that's why I asked Don Hall about
very charismatic.
That.
He was a very charismatic person. He was very, he could convince you, you talk about people who could, sell sand in the desert.
Yeah.
He was one of those people that just was so passionate about what he had in his head and his drive that people would follow him and trust in him and let him do these things. And you know, poor Roy was along for the ride and always making things happen and helping his little brother.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, he had that kind of magnetism. He had that personality that he was trustworthy and genuine and sincere, and people loved to help him.
Right. And he was not a real outgoing guy, though. I mean, he wasn't really like a flamboyant type, you know, out there and I'm, you know, pounding his own chest and this sort of thing. They said he never... he never spoke, he never yelled, and he just talked to you.
Quiet.
And it was very simple, what he was telling you, very believable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's
very
what
honest.
Everybody attached themselves to and just went, you know what, that's a guy you can believe.
Yeah, and he wasn't a big shot. I mean, he was a big shot in Hollywood, but he didn't act
huge,
like one.
Yeah.
And he was right there in the trenches, you know, and almost every penny he ever made at Disney, he put back into making things bigger and better quality. And and he wasn't in it for the money. He wasn't in it for the fame or glory. He just wanted to do art, and we make art and do it at the best possible job he could. He just always wanted to make it better.
It's a real study. I mean, he obviously, he had to be a showman, mm-hmm. not a show business
show off.
Person.
He was not
right.
a show off.
But
he was a showman, not a show off.
That brought people in. And then I think about the relationship that he had with trust and love with his wife. All of these pieces just seem to tell the story, and I think it mm-hmm. carries out in this exhibition. You look at the man mm-hmm. and his life,
right.
but it's come to life in these experiences.
Just look at this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So you have the opportunity. You have the opportunity to touch all those things.
Yeah,
what's it? I'm sorry, I turned into your own interview.
You're okay. Right? Hey, I'm going
done?
Over here for
sorry,
about 10 minutes.
We'll
I'll be fine.
I've always wanted to be in television. And I've asked you this. So what's it like when you have some of those artifacts that you actually have your... I know you wear your white gloves when you can.
I wear my white gloves,
but
yes.
when you do things like that, tell me what that feels like in your soul.
You know, I get that childlike wonder whenever I touch some of these things. When I'm leafing through the Sleeping Beauty storybook or I'm holding the snow globe from Mary Poppins, to me, those things give me a visceral thrill. I mean, I still... can't believe somebody trusts me to take care of these things. And I come in and I walk through the studio and I'm walking in literally in Walt's footsteps and walking through his office and working with the things that he touched. And it's magic. It's seeing them behind glass is one thing, but actually being able to touch them.
Yeah.
is so special, and I feel so blessed.
See the face, see the eyes.
I saw it.
That is it. And there's one artifact in this exhibition that everyone must sit on a bench and study. Tell them what that is. It's your favorite piece in this special room, the camera.
This one where
in the room over there. You told me the camera.
Yeah.
The story is so magnificent.
There's one of the galleries that we have is called The World Around Us, and mm-hmm. it's basically about Walt's love of nature and nature documentaries and putting nature into our parks and things. But one of the little displays in there is based on the South America trip from 1941, where he took animators down to South America to kind of absorb the culture down there and to make a film, which turned out to be Saludos Amigos.
Mm-hmm.
And he just took his little camera, I think it's a Bell and Howell, little camera that he took just to take photos of the group and to kind of take travel log mm-hmm. photos for himself. And they animated the cartoon down there. They came back to the studio, we're going to put it all together, and they realized they didn't have enough footage. Animated. And so they took Walt's camera, which is in the case here, and they took the footage from that and they interspliced it in with the animation. And so when you're watching that film, in many cases, you're watching actual footage that Walt took with his home movie camera.
Wow.
And it's in the film, you know.
Wow.
And so when you're watching other animators working or you're mm-hmm. watching a party or whatever, a lot of that footage was shot by Walt Disney himself with this tiny little camera. And it's here in the exhibit.
I caught her this morning sitting on a bench and studying that.
Yeah, I love that.
Longingly looking at it. I said, so what is that? Then she told the story.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone that's listening to this podcast, when you go into that room, sit there with the all-knowing Becky sat and study that artifact and see her
very
face
special.
Telling the story.
And they really couldn't have any better person doing this than you.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, you're an LA girl, you're Burbank, you're right down the street from Burbank and Glendale. Born and raised, told that you're a theater major. You had no idea at that time you'd end up at Disney. But I think being in the theater, props,
mm-hmm.
behind the scenes costumes,
costume
all this
too.
Stuff, you become the director of archives. You're the only employee at the time. It was 1993, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you walk in there, What was your first thought? There isn't enough stuff here from this guy?
Oh, no. Well,
we need more stuff, or what is the deal?
Well, I'm actually the second director of the archives.
Okay.
The first one was the very first person was Dave Smith, who founded the archives in 1970. And he did it all by himself, one guy. His first job was to inventory Walt's offices. They had been closed up since his passing. And Roy O. Disney, his brother, hired Dave to go in and do this. And then I started working as Dave's secretary in 1993 and worked my way up to taking over when he retired in 2010. But the thing was, is that I had this deep love for Disney from my childhood and what I had learned. But I learned so much by osmosis, just listening to Dave's phone calls, reading the books that he told me to read, just learning the collection and everything. But it was still mostly a research collection when I became director. And one of the things that, God bless them, you know, Bob Iger and the whole executive structure at Disney encouraged us to do some more outreach. We always had a mission for the archives. It was to, you know, protect and preserve the history of the company. But I added in there to share, so to protect, preserve, and share the history of the Walt Disney Company. And so we were able to go out and start bringing in these dimensional collections. And I started getting ride vehicles and real cars and sailing ships and chariots and costumes. And we had one rack of costumes that had about 15 costumes on it at that time. And now we have thousands. And we had, you know, if it couldn't fit in a little box, we didn't have it. And we branched out in about 2006. And I've started now. I get first choice off of anything off of our films. If a ride is reimagined or shut down for some reason, we get to take the things that people love the most.
We'll remember.
Yeah, and so that's why we have this really rich collection, not only documentation, and we have 25 million photos. And the thing about it that's so amazing is that we were able to bring this all together, and the company has supported us in creating a collection that can fill exhibits like this.
Wow, that's incredible. So how do you, you have probably millions of artifacts, correct? Literally.
When you include paper,
Yeah, right. how do you know what to include and what to bring, say, to Kansas City for this particular exhibition?
That was the hardest thing about coming up with this exhibition, was not only figuring out thematically how we were going to do it, but we have this wealth of material. And what we had to do is look at it and say, okay, what story are we trying to tell in this gallery? And what pieces do we have that will tell that story just with a glance? And so we had to eliminate so many possibilities, and what to leave out was the hardest part.
Right.
But we went through, and each image was carefully curated. Every single thing that you see in here was thought over and discussed, and we figured out what was going to tell the story the best, and then put it in here.
How long did it take you to whittle it all down and then go, okay, we're headed to Philadelphia or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay, here's what we got. So,
yeah, it was about 5 years.
It took you 5 years.
We started it in 2013, or 2018. And as George was saying, Semmel Entertainment, was we put out a request for bids for producers. And they were fantastic. We met them. We started working with them. And so we actually did most of the development on this exhibit during the pandemic with them in Berlin and one of our lead designers in Maui and the rest of us in between somewhere. And so we did it through Zoom. We designed this exhibit mostly through Zoom because none of us were in the office. We were doing it from home over the computers, and we made it happen.
Yeah, and George, you had to show them we got space. We got plenty of room here at Union Station.
And you have to share the quality that we have.
Absolutely.
You know, we're not a touring exhibition space.
Yeah.
This is what we try to do, is transform a touring exhibition into a permanent history exhibition. And it's much different. But we love to add the theatrics and the emotion. When you come to Union Station, we have an ASCAP award contract, so you can hear the Disney music playing the minute you get here. So the moment you see something on social media, to the minute you get here, the minute you park your car, to the minute you experience this exhibition, to the moment you leave, it needs to be magical, and it needs to set the tone, because that's our goal. We have been entrusted with this great human being's emotion and artifacts. And if we don't bring that to life, it's our failure. Yeah. So I hope that we will, and we will. We've learned it over the time frame. So we're honored that Walt is here. Yeah. And I'm really honored that you're here.
Oh, thank you.
You know? Yeah, we all are.
You know, George just said something. He mentioned music and the ASCAP and to have it. But also there's a very special thing about this exhibition. If you can hear it, I don't know if you can hear, but there is we have a soundtrack to this exhibit that was purposely made for this. It's never been used before. And a brilliant composer named Steve Mazzaro was hired to create a soundtrack for this exhibition. And it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite parts of the exhibit. Just listening to his music is genius. And then he wove Disney musical moments through it.
Right, you can hear the birds chirping. I always think of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs when I hear all the birds.
You can hear When You Wish Upon a Star. You can even Pirates of the Caribbean, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the soundtrack of this exhibit is wonderful. And then the interactives and the magical little moments of, and this is Semmel did such an amazing job of, you know, having the little birds fly out of the snow globe, or having Tinkerbell come in and start the fireworks over the castle.
Exactly.
And all those special little moments are the things that you remember.
Yeah. The one thing I don't think a lot of people realize, and I didn't know until I was researching, was When You Wish Upon a Star won the Academy Award in 1940, and it was actually from the movie Pinocchio, correct? Mm-hmm. And it was sung by the voice of Pinocchio,
Cliff Edwards,
exactly. Yeah. But and then it became the theme of Disney, which I didn't know. I thought When You Wish Upon a Star was created because it was Disney, not because it was in the film Pinocchio.
Yeah, because Jiminy Cricket is the one that sang. So Cliff Edwards,
he was Jiminy Cricket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they wanted to make him. He's a very minor character in the original book, but Walt wanted a conscience for Pinocchio, and so he created this little cricket character. And Cliff was had such a beautiful voice, and so they had him not only do the speaking voice, but he was a singer. And When You Wish Upon a Star just was a huge, huge hit, and it's been the theme song of Disney ever since.
Yeah, that's just,
and it gets in your heart.
Oh,
you
it's
it,
in
right?
your heart.
Because it's gorgeous.
You have to imagine and create the brilliance of Walt Disney's company and Walt Disney himself. So even when you look at Union Station, the visual voice, it's lit up in the colors of the exhibition. But more importantly, you'll just all of a sudden notice Tinkerbell is flying across the building.
Yes.
Just so we can engage children, so they'll see that in front of the fountains. There's some great shots you'll see where Mickey and Minnie were out at the historic clock today. So I hope people are proud that it's in Kansas City.
I think they are. I think you've seen it probably through the NFL draft and Super Bowl parades. And all of a sudden, you see Kansas City. Yeah, that was a good place to put this, because they are on a rise right now. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. And, of course, you've got to experience a lot of our wonderful restaurants, some of our barbecue restaurants and some others as well. And so we welcome you to Kansas City. Welcome,
Thank
Disney.
You.
George always has his arms wide open for the next thing. And that is, I think that is why there's just something about Kansas City. That's why we love it so much here.
Yeah, we've been embraced so warmly by the people of Kansas City that we've been talking to and working with. And I have to say, George and his team here at Union Station are a dream to work with. You guys have been so wonderful.
Thanks.
And we really appreciate that.
I'll never be able to get him to shut up now. Forget
I'm done.
It's over.
Call my agent on Thursday.
Yeah, I will. Right? The check's in the mail.
All I care about is you come down and pay for parking, and thank
Absolutely.
You. That keeps my water
no problem.
Bill going.
I got right? my you mean you're not going to give me a stamp for my dog,
no.
George? Come on.
Hey,
okay.
No. God does not give free parking.
I understand how
thank
that
you.
Works.
I got to pay for sewers.
You bet. Right. You bet. Becky, thank you so much for taking time out. I know you have a tremendous schedule here in Kansas City with all the media, and George is dragging you around from spot to spot and making sure that every base is touched here in Kansas City. But thank you so much. You know, come back, see us often.
Many times.
And George.
There's something about Kansas City, and you're the guy. Love you, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you so much, too. That's it. There's something about Kansas City and Disney. Let's face it. 100 years has touched everyone in the world. So
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.